Welcome to Letters Read, the ongoing series of readings in which local performers interpret personal letters by culturally vital individuals from various times and Louisiana communities. I'm stationer Nancy Sharon Collins, project director. Our reader is William Bowling, writer, performer, musician, and ensemble member Goat in the Road Productions. We're here in Sonic Canvas Studio with audio producers Steve Chisick and Steve Himmelfarb. Letters Read events primarily comprise original source material from local archives and special collections. This podcast is one example. It's hosted by Bastion, an intentional community in Gentilly, where wounded, ill, or injured veterans live alongside retired military and civilian volunteers. The subject of this reading is a small portion of letters and personal documents donated to the Historic New Orleans Collection in 2018 by Frank Perez, current president of the LGBT Plus Archives Project of Louisiana. As the story goes, this particular collection was left on Frank's desk in a nondescript plastic bin, anonymously. Most of the bin contained personal papers from Bob Stewart, who passed away in his Bywater home in 2014. Contents of the bin now comprise the Robert W. Stewart Papers Collection at the Historic New Orleans Collection, gifted by Frank Perez, accession number 2018-0225. A native of Shreveport, Louisiana, Stewart first came to New Orleans to study at Tulane in the 1940s. He graduated from Louisiana State University with a degree in psychology. He joined the Navy during World War II, was honorably discharged, and also studied psychology at the University of Tennessee. Like many who had served, Stewart returned home and commenced a normative life. In the early 1950s, Stewart began a lifelong civil service career in New Orleans. This podcast weaves selected letters from Stewart's early adulthood with contextual information to frame the arc of these formative years. With a few exceptions, I'll be the voice of general history, and Will reads letters and documents personal to Stewart. There's a one-minute interview with a third voice that refers to the plastic bin. Most of the correspondence Will reads dates from the 40s, from friends Bob made in the military and while studying at Tulane, LSU, and UT. Some letters contain veiled and others obvious reference to same-sex attraction, activity, and performance. Remember, Will reads personal letters intended for the eyes of our subject. It is important to keep in mind that these letters were written when being gay or queer was illegal in many instances and considered by the federal government, the military, and much of America a perversion or illness.
1941, September 17th, Inn at the Sea, past Christian, Mississippi, beside the emerald waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Dear Stu, undoubtedly the primary news is this. I have completely changed sexually. I now even think normally. Isn't that wonderful? I'll give you the gruesome details that caused the transformation when I go to Baton Rouge. Since you have seen Ed's shining morning face, or morning, as you may have it, you won't need the snapshot, but I'm sending it anyway. I met a fairly intelligent boy at the tryouts. His name, oddly enough, is Jack Adams. Doesn't that sound fictitious? Maggie brought him. Where she picked him up, I don't know. When I asked, both she and Jack were loath to tell. After Monday's tryouts, Jack, Maggie, and I went up to Jack's garret to rouse two friends of his who had come down from Iowa in the most ramshackle Model T Ford convertible I have ever seen. They, too, seemed quite intelligent, even more than Jack. We dragged them from their warm bed, there's only one bed for three people, and took them to Café Lafitte. Bob, who looks oldest, beard, praise God, has histrionic aspirations. Otto, blonde, very, very Aryan, Schroeder is his surname, is really nice, is an artist. When you come down here, perhaps we can all get together and have another hell of a good time. I'll probably visit you next weekend, the one after the present one. Write me full directions as to where to meet you. I'll tell you in my next letter exactly what time I intend to leave here and what time I will arrive there. But don't wait for that before you send me those directions. Make it your business to see Ed so you can tell him for me that I'm coming up and that I'm looking forward to seeing him. Don't tell Harry Lindner. Well, dear, I have exhausted paper, pencil, and mind, so I'll go back to my state of lethargy until I hear from you, and it had better be soon. Love, Jerry. P.S. Don't wait to answer this, but do so immediately, so I'll feel sure about the trekking to Baton Rouge.
1941, December 7. Pearl Harbor attacked. December 11, the United States officially declares war against Germany.
From the offices of H.S. Weissman, Vice President in Charge of Sales, M.L. Bath Companies, Shreveport, Louisiana, November 26, 1942. To Officer in Charge, Naval Recruiting Services, New Orleans, Louisiana. Dear Sir, as you know, the activity of the Lions Club in Louisiana is to sponsor recruiting for the Navy. The attached card is to introduce to you Mr. Robert Warren Stewart, who is now a student at the Louisiana State University. It is a privilege for the undersigned to send this young man to you. His father is a true American and a veteran of the First World War, and the young man is a true American and a son of a fine gentleman, whose qualifications are proven to me, as for about 6 years we worked together for the above company. In the interim, however, I kept in close contact with the father of Robert Warren Stewart, and have watched this said young man pass by this place of business from the time he was a mere infant and into young manhood. The writer is past chef de guerre of the 40-8. On the executive board of the American Legion and other civic and patriotic organizations. Also, I am vice president in charge of sales for the above company. I trust that the young man being recommended will be successful in his every wish and desire. Yours very truly, H.S. Weissman.
1942, December 5. Stewart enlists in the Navy rated PHM-3C, a special branch, a sort of catch-all for several dissimilar ratings. As such, it held a number of unique paths through which, should he have remained in the military, Stewart could have become a petty officer.
May 18th, 1943. Stu, I've been accepted by the Navy. Luda sing cuckoo! I received notice yesterday that I am to appear for service on the 1st of June. At first, I shall be on non-combatant duty, and for a long while will be only a common seaman. But it's just as Robbie Byrne says. Nilhamanus, nilhamanus, augustiae et omne quid. Notatum arum ordo est, arum vir per omne quid. I have given notice to CD Incorporated that I intend on leaving on or about the 15th of June, and it may be sooner. I would like very much to take a short vacation, during which I might go bicycling and swimming. Of course I shall visit you too. Don't fret, my pet. Poetry. Gee. I shan't be departing from the sunny Sooth and its beautiful termity plantations and rolling pellagra-ridden swamps. Oh, no. I will attend Tulane for a short while. What do you think of the title of my next poem? It is to be Tawdry Audrey, or La Dame de Dustin. And it is to have absolutely nothing to do with the odd poem it introduces. I must publish it before I go to Afghanistan or Walla Walla. Do look about you for a woman to whom I might apply my latest epitaph. A horrible woman. I'm glad she is dead. So gracious, loquacious, and witty in bed. A portion has been edited from here. Avec amour, Roy.
As with life elsewhere in the United States, serving for one's country offered little pride for the partnering choices of gay service people. 1945, Veterans Benevolent Association, VBA, was founded. The first national organization for gays. VBA members, in coalition with the NAACP, campaigned to end issuance of blue discharges, which were disproportionately being assigned to homosexuals and African Americans alike. While issued only by the Army and Army Air Corps, predecessor to today's Air Force, so-called blue discharges branded anyone who got one forever, denying them benefits, in some cases to this day, such as healthcare benefits and access to VA loans.
January 16th, 1946. Dear Colonel Stewart, many times I have recaptured the vision of the pipe in mouth and book in hand record office, Mao and Map counterpart, and I have felt that it would have been comforting to have reached out and have been able to touch you. But the only times I took advantage of such opportunity when the flesh was near was at times when you had questions concerning some of the office procedures, and I would tweak your knee or run a quick grope up and down the leg. So I guess I really am not the opportunist that I imagined myself to be. As you readily know, most of us live in schizoid frames, and we are what we are expected to be under certain conditions and surroundings. The whole approach to knowing you evidently was the deviated one. But I thank you for sharing many hours of warm subterranean camaraderie that recognized me as a person of some spiritual kinship. I recall an hour or two with one of your poems, probably more, and the letters you shared with me from your friend from New York, and I was pleased that you even desired to share. The letter continues for a few pages, and is signed, Emil Strom, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Excerpt from These People Are Frightened to Death, Congressional Investigations and the Lavender Scare, article by Judith Atkins, National Archives, 2016. Quote, beginning in the late 1940s and continuing through the 60s, thousands of gay employees were fired or forced to resign from the federal workforce. It was a time when the country was dealing with tremendous social change and rising anxiety about another lurking threat. Communism. Enter Senator Joseph McCarthy, whose rhetoric explicitly associated communists and gay people, turning the slow burn of repression into a firestorm. Close quote.
C-2454-844. Honorable discharge from the United States Navy. This is to certify that Robert Warren Stewart, Pharmacist's Mate, 3rd Class, is honorably discharged from the United States Naval Personnel Separation Center, New Orleans, Louisiana, and from the Naval Service to the United States this third day of May, 1946. This certificate is awarded as a testament of fidelity and obedience. Signed, Lieutenant, U.S. Naval Reserve, by direction.
Excerpt from Employment of Homosexuals and Other Sex Perverts in Government, Interim Report Submitted to the Committee on Expenditures, United States Senate, December 15, 1950, page 3. Quote, psychiatric physicians generally agree that indulgence in sexually perverted practices indicates a personality which has failed to reach sexual maturity. The authorities agree that most sex deviants respond to psychiatric treatment and can be cured if they have a genuine desire to be cured. However, many overt homosexuals have no real desire to abandon their way of life, and in such cases, cures are difficult. The subcommittee sincerely believes that persons afflicted with sexual desires, which result in their engaging in overt acts of perversions, should be considered as proper cases for medical and psychiatric treatment. Close quote. New Orleans, 1950s. Stewart began his career as the director of training for the Office of Civil Defense.
City of New Orleans, Office of the Mayor, September 16, 1957. To Mr. Robert W. Stewart, 1216 St. Charles Avenue, Apartment C, New Orleans, Louisiana. Dear Mr. Stewart, it is with much gratification that I transmit this commendatory letter concerning the research work accomplished during Phase 2 of the New Orleans Metropolitan Area Survival Plan Project. The diligence and sincerity of interest in civil defense exemplified by the individuals, the committee, and the contractual firms as recognized by all echelons reflect great credit upon the local civil defense organization and upon the entire metropolitan area of New Orleans. The basic letter leaves me with but one comment, namely, it is fully acknowledged that for the quality and effectiveness of this work, we are deeply indebted to you and your co-workers. The credit is yours. Sincerely, Deliceps S. Morrison, Mayor, City of New Orleans.
The anonymous donor of Stewart's papers, the man dropping the unremarkable plastic bin on Frank's desk at the LGBT Plus Archives Project, was Mark Cotton. In this 60-second clip, I ask Mark, what do you do?
I do estate sales.
What does that mean?
When someone passes away, the family will contact me, or I've been contacted by the person before they passed away, to come in afterwards and basically dispose of all the belongings of the house. So usually the house can be put on the market for sale.
What do you do when you walk into a house after you've made the arrangements, agreements with whoever you are, when you actually start working on it?
Start working. Usually you start looking in cabinets, drawers, taking things out, putting it out where you can see it, figure out what you're going to keep and try and resell versus one, give away, two, trash. I guess that's it.
Cotton handled Stewart's estate, organizing and dispersing the physical remains of a gay man's life. Stewart was in his 90s when he passed. Cotton was also Stewart's backyard neighbor. They'd known each other for about 15 years. Wondering how he came to possess these particular letters, I interviewed Cotton. Mark explained that, in addition to managing estate sales professionally, he's made it his business to find the proper disposition for a deceased person's personal property that, otherwise, might end up in the trash. Beyond the nice clothes, the rare book collection, the fine art and furniture in Bob's house, were his papers. Personal letters from intimate friends, work accolades, and a growing passion for civil rights activism centered on LGBTQ plus laws and issues. As Cotton describes, Bob Stewart was tall, well-spoken, very smart, well-dressed, polite. He was a gentleman. You can see this in the dapper photo of him in his summer whites in front of Commander's Palace on the Letters Read website. Mark says Bob was the kind of guy who would, well, he would just help. He tells the story of one letter I've not read from the plastic bin, now at the Historic New Orleans Collection. A thank you note from a young man down on his luck here in New Orleans. One of Bob's bohemian friends, Bob was wont to hang with artistic types, introduced him to this kid with a broken down auto. No place to stay and no way to get home. Bob let him sleep on his sofa a few nights, gave him gas money, and probably fed him so the kid could get back home to rural Alabama. It makes sense to Mark that Bob's career would be helping people, because helping came naturally to Bob Stewart.
September 10th, 1959, Department of Welfare, Director, New Orleans Civil Defense. Sick and annual leave credit due Mr. Robert W. Stewart. On September 7th, 1959, Mr. Robert W. Stewart was transferred from this department to the Department of Welfare. Accordingly, we are submitting below his unused leave balances as per our records compiled through September 7th, 1959. Annual leave, 89 days. Sick leave, 173 and two-thirds days. Very truly yours, Robert V. Moraist, Brigadier General, United States Army, retired. Director, New Orleans Civil Defense. Copied. Bureau of Accounting, Robert W. Stewart.
By the 1960s, Stewart was the Assistant Director of the Youth Study Center, now the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center for Orleans Parish, a pretrial detention center for youths charged with committing a delinquent offense. It's under the Department of Children and Family Services and part of the Louisiana welfare system. Simultaneously, America was beginning to catch a little glimmer of insight into a world the government was trying so hard to suppress. John McGill, retired curator and senior historian, the Historic New Orleans Collection, and a Letters Read advisor, told me about the 1964 Life magazine article that vividly sticks in his memory. Will reads from the June 26th article by Ralph Graves, titled, "A Secret World Grows Open and Bolder. Society is Forced to Look at It and Try to Understand It." Will reads from the article, illustrated by a night scene of a gay leather bar in San Francisco by life photographer Bill Epridge.
"These brawny young men in their leather caps, shirts, jackets, and pants are practicing homosexuals, men who turn to other men for affection and sexual satisfaction. They are part of what they call the gay world, which is actually a sad and often sordid world. On these pages, life reports on homosexuality in America, on its locale and habits, and sums up what science knows and seeks to know about it. Homosexuality shears across the spectrum of American life, the professions, the arts, business, and labor. It always has. But today, especially in big cities, homosexuals are discarding their furtive ways and openly admitting, even flaunting, their deviation. Homosexuals have their own drinking places, their special assignation streets, even their own organizations. And for every obvious homosexual, there are probably 9 nearly impossible to detect. This social disorder, which society tries to suppress, has forced itself into the public eye because it does present a problem, and parents especially are concerned. The myth and misconception with which homosexuality has so long been clothed must be cleared away. Not to condone it, but to cope with it."
More than a decade later, we turn to an excerpt from Gay Rights Referendum, McNeil-Lehrer Report. The transcript, many pages in length, is one of the earliest example in Stewart's collection referring to his growing gay rights activism. June 6, 1977, Educational Broadcasting Corporation. Will and I trade off, Will as Robert McNeil, me as Jim Lehrer, then Will again as the commercial announcer for repeal, and then me against repeal. Again, this is 1977.
Robert McNeil. "Good evening. Of all the social issues that have gripped this country recently, none has stirred any fiercer emotions than that of so-called gay rights. And the event that has really turned up the heat for and against homosexuality across the nation takes place in Miami tomorrow. Voters of Dade County will go to the polls in a referendum to repeal or leave as is an ordinance banning discrimination against homosexuals in housing, employment, and public accommodations. The ordinance was passed by the Dade County Metro Commission in January. A campaign began almost immediately to repeal it, and the passions that campaign aroused have attracted national attention. Tonight, with Jim Lehrer in Miami on the eve of the vote, we look at the issues facing what the Washington Post calls the first city in the nation to be faced with declaring what it thinks of homosexuality by popular vote. Jim?
Jim Lehrer in Miami. Robin, a local TV commentator, probably summed it up best the other night. For Miami, he said, it's a no-win deal no matter what the voters do. If the ordinance is repealed, some will say Miami is anti-civil rights. If it isn't, then others will claim Miami is soon to become a haven for homosexuals. This either-or view of things is explicit in the slick TV commercials that both sides have run in this bitter, show-busy battle. Here's a sample from each side's arsenal.
For repeal, commercial announcement. The Orange Bowl Parade. Miami's gift to the nation. Wholesome entertainment. But in San Francisco, when they take to the streets, it's a parade of homosexuals. Men hugging other men, convorting with little boys, wearing dresses and makeup. The same people who turned San Francisco into a hotbed of homosexuality want to do the same thing to Dade County. On June 7th, vote for the human rights of your children. Vote for repeal of Metro's dangerous homosexual ordinance.
Against repeal. Commercial announcement. All men are created equal. No, wait. Wait a minute. Everybody but homosexuals. Some people want to decide who's going to have human rights and who isn't. Here, it's the rights of homosexuals. But somewhere else, it might be Jews, or people with foreign names, or women, or anybody. When you start tearing away at the foundations of our country, where does it stop? For some, it may be difficult now to imagine an America in which it's not okay to wear one's gender identity and gender expression on one's coat sleeve, tattooed on one's arm in an email signature or preferred pronoun. Think about it. Only a few brief months ago, in this year, June 15, 2020, the United States Supreme Court ruled that you can no longer be fired for being gay. Will continues.
In a landmark opinion authored by Justice Neil Gorsuch, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Title VII's prohibition of employment discrimination based on sex applies to both sexual orientation and gender identity. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is the federal law that prohibits discrimination in the workplace on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, and sex.
Bob was born in 1923. Only 3 years prior, women had won the right to vote. Locally, the Great Flood of 27, then internationally came the Great Depression. I view Bob's life through a lens of two historic black and white movies, Birth of a Nation and The Jazz Singer. The former, 1915, is a Reconstruction-era pageant depicting the birth of the Ku Klux Klan and weirdly biased Southern justification advocating for white supremacy. The latter, starring Al Jolson in blackface, defying his character's Northern, urban, Orthodox Jewish upbringing to go on stage. In a pang of regret, he returns to his conservative family. What do these models of popular culture say to a young man growing up in Jim Crow-era Louisiana, surrounded by the remnants of old-fashioned male chivalry and staunch heteronormative values? Imagine, if you will, a young man white, with possibilities, a.k.a. entitled, in New Orleans, Louisiana in the 1950s, with alternative thoughts and wandering desires. What do you think that felt like? I offer one last letter and then a poem, both sent to Robert Wayne Stewart in a time when it was truly dangerous to be queer. The letter is from Isabel, a cisgender heterosexual female in Bob's close network. I'm going to take a shot at interpreting her dream and say it dawns on her that her buddies may have other partnering interests in mind than bedding her. I'll read as Isabel. Finally, Will reads the poem by one of Stewart's friends, either John Roy Miller or Rafe Dubrovner. Oh, the dream I had. It was one of those tenuous, transparent things, but very real. In fact, when I woke up, I thought I'd actually sat on the phone and talked to you during the night. In my dream, there was a phone connection between you and me. I don't know whether you called me or vice versa, but at first I heard you distinctly, yet your voice, while audible, seemed so far away, not as to space or distance, but having an unearthly quality, incorporeal, spiritual. It was as though you were leaving the mortal world. There was something supernatural about it. I asked you where you were, and you wouldn't say, and gradually your voice became fainter, until I couldn't hear you at all. I was imploring you to say something, but you didn't. I felt that you were struggling under some mental burden that you wanted to speak but couldn't, and that your will was ebbing so that finally you were resigned to whatever it was that controlled you. I was horrified. I kept yelling at the operator, but the connection was unbroken. You were still at the phone, yet gradually receding farther into an unknown destiny. I realized that you were going somewhere beyond my power to reach you. The strange thing is that it lasted so long. No action. It was all atmosphere. Yours, Isabel.
The quiet laughter is not forgotten, nor the love, although it now is lost. The laughter was the words of love that were not said. The words unsaid. The laughter now is left the echo of a love that could not be in words, but was in laughter.
Thank you, Sherry Beck and Bastian. Thank you, Steve and Steve. Thanks to Antenna, Letters Read Fiscal Partner, to 2020 Funders, Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, Corner and Reba Judith Sandler Foundations. Thanks to Mark Cotton, to our Executive Advisory Board, Christopher Kamenstein, Michelle Verisco, Cole Halpern, and our many friends and supporters. Thank you, Rebecca Smith, Amy Everett, and Robert Tickner at the Williams Research Center for helping me research. Thank you, Frank, for introducing me to the letters. Many thanks to Goat in the Road Productions for lending great artistic guidance and talent. Stay tuned later this month for two more podcasts. One of our incubator-style short productions featuring letters from the first yellow fever epidemic in Louisiana. And rounding out the 2020 programming season, the studio conversation between two Lafayette, Louisiana actors discussing the work of Tennessee Williams and his career and the theater. Stay tuned for Letters Read 2021, Doing Business in New Orleans.